morning. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Giorgio. We're delighted to be involved with the Gideons, and it really touches my heart to see a parachurch organization wanting so badly to partner with a local church worldwide. And my dad, it's too bad Frank and Lois aren't here today. My dad was a Gideon many years, and as a kid, I would go to Gideon conventions, and all I can say is this is not your grandfather's Gideons, the one that we know now. And Gideon's Canada has done so well and leading the way, and we're grateful to be partnering with you all. Well, the text has just been written, John chapter 21, verses 15 to the end. And the title of the message is simply the Lord's last words in the gospel. You follow me, or you must follow me. The trajectory and temptations of finishing well. So we've been in this series now for almost a year. We've taken breaks here and there through the summer and for Advent and so on. And we come to the end of this incredible gospel, which is quite unique, quite different from the other three. And John wraps things up here, but not without first including this really famous conversation that Peter and Jesus have together. And though the whole narrative of the resurrection and the post-resurrection appearances kind of describes the seriousness of discipleship and the seriousness of Christian leadership, you just can't help but sense the Lord's excitement in what's going on here. If you were here last week, we read the story of the miraculous catch of fish. And, I mean, how fun would it have been for the Lord to speak into the lives of his troubled and discouraged disciples as they're out in the fishing boat trying to fish and catching nothing? He yells out, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" Of course, they don't know who he is, and they respond, "No." And I see the Lord's eyes sparkling with anticipation and kind of rubbing his hands together, saying to himself, "Oh boy, am I going to have fun with this one." And in the course of what seems like 5 minutes, the disciples go from one kind of struggling to another kind of struggling. They go from struggling catching no fish to catching so many fish they can't even haul the fish into the boat. And then as the Lord kind of witnesses what happens next, John sees that it's Jesus and announces to the fishermen, "It's the Lord," and Peter kind of does a swan dive off the bow of the boat, and, you know, in comes Peter and everybody following. I just can only imagine how the Lord was reveling in every detail. But it's not the fish that the Lord is so excited about, and the large catch of fish, as we saw last week. What he's the most excited about is the fire, and the invitation that happens between the fish and the fire. The Lord, it seems, can't wait to have a fireside conversation with his fallen and forgiven friend, Peter. And we can't miss this, that the Gospel of John ends with Jesus, the great reconciler, restoring and reinstating his friend, Peter. That's how John and the Holy Spirit wants the book to end. The reconciler is doing his work. He's pulling all things towards himself. And this is what the text is about today, and it's about how following Jesus to the finish line, when the idealism of youth has been tarnished by failure, has the Lord's special touch and the Lord's special presence. So, let's take a look. The text is not that long, and it can be broken down quite nicely into four movements: the meal, the call, the bombshell, and the temptation. Meal, call, bombshell, and temptation. So first of all, let's look at the meal. So look at verse 15, the first few words. It says, "When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, 'Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?'" What I want to focus in on for a moment is that little phrase, "when they had finished eating." This is not a superfluous detail. John wants to make sure that we know that they ate first. The meal comes first. There are very important things to talk about for sure, but only after the sacramental meal embodying complete acceptance has been consumed together. For if Peter, or anybody else for that matter, jumps right back into feeding sheep, or jumps back into ministry, as we would call it, before he himself has been truly fed deep in his soul, his ministry won't be sustainable. Yes, Peter's shame is real. His shame over the threefold denial, it requires the Lord's discipline. Reconciliation needs to happen. The two guys need to talk, for sure. But in Middle Eastern culture, food and a meal, breaking bread, has a language all of its own. Breaking bread is the language of love if you live in the Middle East. It's the language of acceptance, forgiveness. The language that says our lives right now are merging back together again. So as Jesus, if you can imagine this, as he is tossing Peter a second piece of fish from the fire, Peter knows exactly what this means. It means he's already forgiven. The debt has been fully paid. The presence of the charcoal fire with bread and fish on it is a dead giveaway if you're a Jew in the first century. And isn't it interesting that Jesus doesn't even bring up Peter's sin, not once in the whole conversation? He doesn't say, "Oh, Peter, man, you and I got something to talk about. Three times in one night, and once it was a little girl saying, 'I detect your accent. Aren't you from Galilee? Are you one of Jesus' disciples?'" No. No, Peter doesn't even go there. It appears that the sin is at the bottom of the Sea of Galilee somewhere, and Jesus and Peter are not going fishing for it. The meal says it all. In fact, that would be a good title for a book on the Eucharist. The meal says it all. That's where the text starts. I also think that considering our church and our kitchen, that what the meal does Monday, Wednesday, and Friday is it actually invites people to belong before they believe. And nobody ever asks them to confess their sins or to tell us first their history, because the meal says it all. And over time, we turn relief work into belief work, but it takes the meal first. This also should say something to us about our broken relationships and what we think needs to happen in order for the relationship to be restored. Maybe we think that we need a really serious long talk about all the water that's gone under the bridge, and we probably do. But maybe an invitation for coffee is way more important than getting off our heart what needs to come out. That'll come in time. The meal. Secondly, the call. Now, though the Lord doesn't talk to Peter about his sin, he does talk to him about his heart. He says, "Simon, son of John," which is his formal name before Jesus called him Petrus, the rock, "do you love me more than these?" Now, we're actually not sure if Jesus is asking whether Peter loves Jesus more than the boats and the fish and the career of fishing, or whether Jesus is asking if Peter loves him more than the other disciples. It's just not clear. Jesus apparently is pointing, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And we don't know where everybody's looking. And in many ways, it doesn't matter, because Peter simply responds, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And some of you are probably familiar with the fact that when Jesus says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He uses the Greek word agape. So do you love me with the deepest form of godly self-sacrificing love? And Peter responds, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. But he doesn't use the word agape. He used the word phileo. So yes, Lord, you know that I love you as a brother. And then Jesus says, no, do you agape me? And he says, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. And then Jesus says, okay, well, if you want to go that way, Simon, son of John, do you phileo me? Yes, Lord, I phileo you. And C.S. Lewis has written a whole book on it called The Four Loves, and many people have preached whole sermons on the different Greek words, and I think there's probably something there. It's an important, but it hasn't caught my attention today or this week. What has is that the Lord asks Peter three times, and the third time, it hurts Peter deeply. It hurts his feelings. And it's important that we see here what's going on. Jesus is about to reinstate Peter as a spiritual leader and a shepherd, as a pastor, as an apostle, but it's not going to be a very effective reinstatement or a lasting reinstatement unless Peter engages Jesus at a heart level. So three times Jesus, in effect, says, can we talk about love? He doesn't want to talk about sin, Jesus, but he wants to talk about love. Can we talk about your heart? Do you love me more than you love these? Oh, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Now remember, this conversation where Jesus goes over the same thing three times is happening at a charcoal fire. Jesus asks Peter three times if he loves him at a charcoal fire. And the last time Peter was sitting by a charcoal fire, somebody else asked him if he loved Jesus. Aren't you one of his? No, I'm not. And Luke tells us that when the rooster finally crowed after the third denial, he tells us that Jesus looked straight at Peter. And I don't know what was in the Lord's eyes, but I can only imagine that it was hurt. Peter, it's me that you're denying. And the text says that remembering the Lord's predictions that Peter would betray Jesus three times, Peter went out and wept bitterly. So that's the last time that Peter and Jesus have had a connection. The last look was that look at the charcoal fire after the threefold denial. So the last encounter they had wasn't a very pleasant one. You could say it didn't end on a good note. And so now, by the warmth of another charcoal fire that Jesus recreates, and after the mind-blowing catch of fish and the stomach-filling feast of fish, Jesus says, can we bring your stomach and your head together in the place of the heart and talk about affections? Can we talk about love? See, and I'm talking as a sheep feeder about one of the most famous sheep feeders, Peter. And if Peter jumps back into ministry before his heart has been fully re-engaged for the right reasons, his ministry is going to run the risk of leaning in one of two directions, both of which will be destructive for him personally and for everybody else that he seeks to feed. So on the one hand, in order to overcompensate for his failure, Peter could become the most hardworking yet the most driven of all apostles, the guy you'd never want to work for. He wouldn't be able to tolerate any half-heartedness in himself or in anybody else. He would be a tyrant of a leader. Gary Burge puts it this way: this sort of Christianity, so familiar to ardent conservatives, is destructive. It produces a spiritual regimen that is merely a Protestant penance. You know, because I failed God in my youth, and because I failed myself, I have a lot of ground to make up for. So put on your hard hat. And here we go. You don't want a boss like that. And Jesus doesn't want Peter or anybody else feeding sheep in an effort to pay Jesus back. Because Jesus can't be paid back. Every effort Peter makes to redeem himself or make up for relational deprivation is just going to end in failure and disappointment. And so Jesus says, Peter, can we talk about your heart? And on the other hand, if Peter's heart somehow remains distant or untouched by the Lord's really experiential forgiveness, then he may jump back into ministry, but he's going to run the risk of having shame completely erode his soul. For the burden of unforgiven sin will make effective ministry impossible. If somehow Jesus and Peter's hearts are not completely reconciled together, Peter will never be a very good ambassador of reconciliation for others. And we know that this is true in our own lives. If you have a fight with your spouse or friend or your son or your daughter, and you say things in a manner that brings wounds to the relationship or wounds to that person, and then for whatever reason you are unable to reconcile that relationship, and there are open wounds, and you leave that relationship, and you go over here, and you seek to minister to other people, it becomes obvious quite quickly that there's incongruence in your life. And this is not going to work long term. That there's a lack of integrity in your life, and that with this new group of people that you're trying to minister to, what's going to happen is because those people are human, they're going to do things and say things that trigger the lack of healing in that relationship. And all the relationships will go south. They will become dysfunctional. And this is why leaders, pastors, shepherds, bosses who are Christians, who give leadership to a particular culture, care so very much about what is under the waterline of a person's life. Above the waterline, the iceberg looks pretty good, but as you get below the surface, you see that there's a whole lot more that we often need to talk about. And you know, I thought about this week when I was a very young pastor hiring staff. The thing that I looked for is what we all look for. I looked for giftedness and maybe even IQ or education and experience. Are you going to be a good team player? And all those things matter a lot. But what matters more is, where are you wounded, and how has Jesus been in the process of healing those wounds? Because, like the Lord's wounds, when your wounds are redeemed, those wounds will become the very source of ministry and a reconciling relationship. But if those wounds have been pushed aside and you don't want to face them and don't want to talk about them and you don't want to bring them into the light, it's only going to be a matter of time, and you will destroy with your character what you build with your gift. Those of you who are leaders and run organizations know exactly what I'm talking about. Peter, Jesus says, I'm calling you to feed my sheep, but the feeding of sheep is so difficult. I want you to know that the only way it can be sustained for your whole life is for your heart and my heart to be fully engaged in love. Therefore, I have to ask you this question. Do you love me? Because if you do, and if we can talk about your heart, you will be able to love sheep. The two are going to go together. So there's the meal, and then the call, and then number three, the bombshell. Jesus says, in fact, the feeding of sheep is so difficult, let me tell you what your new normal is going to be. He says, you can look at the text if you'd like, I tell you the truth. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and you went where you wanted, but when you were old, you will stretch out your hands and somebody else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. This, Peter, will become your life. You see, Simon, in your early years, you were on your heroic journey. And when young men are on their heroic journey, they need God in order to accomplish their goals in life. You made it happen, Peter. You lit it up. Nobody could dress you. No, you pretty much went where you wanted to go and you did what you wanted to do. You were a high D on the DISC profile. You were an A-type personality. Or if you've done the Berkman, oh, there's something describing this kind of person for sure. You were the first one in the boat and the first one out of the boat and the first one to pull out your sword and the first one to cut off a guy's ear. You were the first one to do everything and everybody followed. But Peter, there's going to be a shift now in your life's trajectory. And as you age, there will be an increase in weakness and a decrease in self-confidence so that you actually won't want to feed sheep anymore. And you will need to become so dependent on me, you'll never go the distance without abiding in the vine. Somebody else is going to dress you, and you're not going to like it. And somebody else is going to lead you, and you're not going to like where they lead you. But here's the good news, Simon Peter. This will bring glory to me. This will be your descent into greatness, more dependent on me, and the downward trajectory is what we call the way of the cross. For unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it simply remains a grain of wheat. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit. We've talked about this before, and if you're new here, this might be new to you. I think this is more relevant for men than it is for women, because I think women tend to be more relational when it comes to their relationships with other women and their relationship with the Lord, but us men tend to place a high degree of significance on achieving goals and making money and buying the house and the cars and having enough for our family to survive. And many of us desperately need God just so that God can become the divine means to an end. But something happens to just about all men between the age of 35 and 50, and those men reach a kind of a crisis of limitation. And what was a heroic journey going up and to the north and all systems go and lots of money and lots of success and lots of popularity suddenly begins to bell curve down. And at the bell curve down, Jesus is standing with his outstretched arms saying, "This is the way forward. It's not the way up, it's the way down. It's the way through death. It's the way of the cross. It's the paschal way. It's the cruciform pattern of life. Come, follow me all the way down. Don't fight to reach that goal. Give it up. You don't need that. Follow me." And men that don't, that just grow older and keep chasing the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, simply become old fools with nothing to give away. But men who choose to bell curve down with Jesus and die to the old dreams that really didn't amount to much in the first place, they become the sages. They become the men and the women that we all want to listen to because they've actually lived the crucified life. And that's what the Lord is saying is going to happen to Peter. But there's one temptation along the way that could derail any of us and detour us off this cruciform path. And so number four is the temptation. And so after the third time that Jesus said, "Feed my sheep," he said to Peter, "Follow me." So the very first two words that Jesus said to Peter when he met Peter were, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And the very last words that he gave him were, "Follow me." But then it says that Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. That was obviously John, and John was following close enough to eavesdrop on the whole conversation because he picked up the whole thing and wrote it down. And when Peter saw John, he said, "And what about him?" So Jesus, remember, he says to Peter, "You, follow me." And Peter looks at John and says, "What about him?" In other words, will he die the same death as me? Will he be on the same downward trajectory? Will his ministry go up or will it go down? Will he make a lot of money? Will he be famous? What about his love? What about his heart? Are you going to have this same talk with John too? What about him? And Jesus replied, and by the way, this is the Bueller Amplified version that none of you have, but just let me read it for you. And Jesus replied, "What about who? Oh, what about him? You mean the guy who beat you on the race to the tomb 3 days ago? Him. You mean the younger, faster, sleeker disciple? Peter. You mean John the Beloved? You mean John my favorite? You mean John the one who's going to spend the rest of his life taking care of my mother? Him? Peter." Now, I'm not sensing any comparison or competition with John, am I? Peter. That's none of your business. If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. I find it really interesting that the last thing that is recorded in the great Gospel of John is a temptation. And it's not money, sex, or power. It's simply comparison. It's competition. You know, those of you that have read John Bunyan's book, The Pilgrim's Progress, know that it's the story of a guy who tried to find release from his burden of sin and finally did. And he was given a scroll, a Bible, to take with him all the way to the celestial city, which is another name for heaven. And when he gets to the celestial city, he swam through the river, he's standing at the gate, and just before the gate opens, it says this, "And then I perceived that even at the gate of heaven, there was a way to hell." Do you remember that? Now, it doesn't really matter to me whether any of us agree or disagree with the theology of John Bunyan, who somehow believed that even at the way of heaven, there was a way to go to hell. I'm not going to debate that today, one way or the other. But what I do want to say is that the Gospel of John ends with a temptation and a test that could derail the very best of us. You must follow me. The remedy of this paralyzing preoccupation with other people and what's going on with other people is simply to keep our eyes on Jesus day after day after day. This is the last thing Jesus says in his gospel. You must follow me. What a good place for the gospel to end. The good news must always conclude with a verdict, with a decision. You follow me. And today, if you feel like you are too far gone or you've committed too many sins, I just want to remind all of us today that every single Sunday in church, there's a charcoal fire. And there's food cooking on that fire. It's the table. It's the Eucharist. And the Lord is saying, don't talk to me about your sin, because your sin was placed on my body and I paid for it in full. You're free. Yes, we need to confess our sins to the Lord. But the Lord doesn't want to make a big deal of that because it's done. The work has been done. But what he does want to do at the charcoal fire of the table is he wants to talk about our heart. And that's why coming forward for the Lord's table every week pushes us every week to not just eat and drink from our head, but to say, oh Lord, I desperately need you to feed my soul today. Thank you for all you have done to give me everything that I need for the next life and for today. Amen.